Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. I hope you're doing all right. If you want to come on the radio, come on my Times radio show and do the quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? Email me now with your details. Get your phone out. You obviously got your phone out. Actually, listen to the podcast. Drop me an email, matt.chorley@times.radio, with your name and your number. We can get you on the radio. We can have a chat, talk a bit about what's going on in the world. You can do the quiz. You might become the Prime Minister. It's matt.chorley@times.radio. Get your phone out and do it now while you're listening to the podcast. Coming up, it's a big day in the awful, dreadful saga of Afghanistan. Boris Johnson convening the meeting of the G7. Obviously, lots of focus on what Boris Johnson and Joe Biden think. But what we thought we'd do is have a tour of the rest of the G7, the other five countries, and find out what each of those countries is doing, public opinion, and the political reaction to what is going on in Afghanistan right now. So that's our big thing, which is coming up in a moment. But first of all, we kick off, as ever, with our columnist panel. It's Tuesday, so it must be Finkelvich. It's Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelvich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Just gets sillier. I've missed that. I feel like we haven't had that for weeks. But they're back. They're back. Daniel Finkelstein, good morning.
Good morning.
And David Ivanovich, morning.
Well, hello.
Good blimey. Normally you just look straight in with a complaint, Dave, but I prefer this.
No, I've decided to be seductive today.
Well, I think that's more in the eye of the beholder, David, but
Do my best.
We shall see. Right, where shall we start? Dominic Raab. Let's talk about Dominic Raab. And one of the bookmakers put out a press release this morning saying he was odds-on favourite to be the first cabinet minister to leave the cabinet. What should Boris Johnson do about him, Danny?
Well, I think I agree with Matthew Paris about this. I don't agree with him about much on this subject, but it's a gigantic displacement activity. This is a massive public disaster, what's happened in Afghanistan, a 20-year-long disaster, because we've ended a 20-year commitment in such a terrible way with terrible consequences for our security, for Western prestige, and all the influence that has on developing democracies and maintaining world security. And whether Dominic Raab was or wasn't on holiday for one telephone call is really secondary. I mean, he obviously did make a mistake, a misjudgment on his part, but I really do think it's a secondary issue. And by the way, just a mere political calculation, it probably reduces the chances of him being moved rather than increases it, just simply because, whereas Boris Johnson might have previously been inclined to move him quietly, now it would be much more difficult to do. So I'm not sure that you know, I've just rebelled against the idea that this is the central issue. It just means that we can avoid all the difficult questions for people like me. Is this kind of intervention possible? Does it work? Can we maintain commitment to it? And all the difficult questions for people who disagree with me, which is, if you don't maintain this kind of intervention, what happens now? And all of it can be dissolved while we discuss whether or not Dominic Raab should or shouldn't have made a telephone call, which probably wouldn't have changed anything.
But does it, I mean, I suppose there's a broader question as to whether or not you feel that Dominic Raab, as Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, is someone particularly grappling with those issues either. It's not just that one phone call. It's more the question of he didn't seem particularly gripped by it before. He went on holiday and delegated it, said he didn't want to be contacted, didn't appear to be particularly across it as an issue.
I don't believe that that his sort of inability to be assiduous or concentrate on his work is really the issue. Britain doesn't have a foreign policy. It's relying on a relationship with the United States when the United States is clearly becoming more isolationist. It hasn't resolved its relationship with the rest of Europe. It now doesn't know what its position is on these sorts of interventions. And that's the problem. As Foreign Secretary, you know, because I've got a very big disagreement with Dominic Raab about one of the central foreign policy issues of our time, which is our relationship with the European Union, it goes without saying that I think he doesn't have a very good strategic view of it. And that's my problem with him. But that's my problem with a lot more than him. Do I think he as a personality is specifically the problem? Do I think his, you know, lack of work ethic is the problem? No, I don't. But do I think Britain's strategic position is a problem? And do I think Dominic Raab is, you know, got a quite a big responsibility for that? Yes.
David, is that the point that actually some of the debate about Dominic Raab and his sun lounger or paddleboarding lesson or whatever it was, is actually, it sort of becomes a shorthand for, is he up to the job of being foreign set? You know, somebody's got to set foreign policy, and the job of foreign secretary should be quite a big job. And is he doing the big sort of strategic thinking? Does he have any idea really of Britain's place in the world?
Yeah, Dan is 90% right, but the 10% that he's wrong is quite interesting, really. He's obviously right that it's a displacement activity. He's obviously right that it's not the kind of big issue. Where he's wrong is, I do think you should be able to expect more from your foreign secretary than staying on holiday when one of the biggest crises that involves Britain is burgeoning and arises. I mean, it is kind of... I mean, it does strike me as kind of 101, really, that somebody calls you and says, you need to come back here, and you go, and you take control, and you put yourself as far as you possibly can at the centre of things in a way consistent with actually getting the best kind of consequence. And the second thing I think about this is, I think it's not untypical of this government under this prime minister. I honestly don't. I think actually it's broadly what you expect to find under this prime minister, and senior ministers seem to have taken their cue from it. Dominic Raab, we know, is one of the most, he's a very, very intelligent man. He is intensely ambitious. And for him to take the message back from somehow or other his prime minister that it didn't really matter if he spent a couple of extra days of on holiday when this was happening is, I think, really indicative of something. So yes, it is a bit of a displacement activity. But forgive me for a moment while I displace myself to say we could do without him.
Just to be clear, I do think that was definitely an error. By the way, I don't think necessarily that if he'd come back to this country, he would have, in quotes, taken control, or that it would have made any difference whatsoever to the situation. But it was an appropriate thing to do. He should have done it. There's so much in what's happened that's a disaster that I sort of rebel against the creation of this issue as a disaster when the issue is so much bigger than that. But just to be clear, I don't disagree with you, David. That is obviously, you're obviously right. And it was definitely a mistake on his part. It's not where my criticism of him lies. I don't think that he's somebody who sort of doesn't take his job seriously and is lazy. I think the problems are different. But I do think this was a mistake.
But is it? I suppose that the question is, you have a view on the situation in Afghanistan, and part of the problem is this conversation always starts, well, I wouldn't start from here. But given where we are right now, This whole situation, the build-up to it, the Britain's relationship with America, the government's ability to forward plan, to take decisions on its own, actually the UK government's ability to get other allies other than America on board, you know, a lot of those, you know, ultimately it goes back to Boris Johnson, but a lot of those questions do run through the Foreign Office, and it's not just about what Dominic Raab didn't do last weekend. But it doesn't suggest big strategic thinking going. Like he's obviously very hardworking. In the, I'm sure he sits and reads his papers and signs them off and all of that. But does he have any idea where Britain should be in 12 months, 5 years, 10 years time in terms of its position in the world? I mean, you get the sense not, David.
It is. I mean, I think Danny laid it out very well. It is extremely difficult. I mean, we discussed some of the things last week, Matt, when you were on holiday. They tried to get
the
hold of
the Prime Minister. Told me it was fine. I was told it was fine for me to stay away for a couple more days.
Exactly. They tried to get you back because they said, look, Danny and David are discussing this and you're going to want to be there and kind of, you know, shepherd it into some kind of conclusion, but you weren't. And we somehow had to kind of manage without you. And you're obviously right. I mean, Biden announced the withdrawal that was going to happen back in April. Somehow or other, and we discussed this last week, we missed it. And by we missed it, we all seem to have missed it. We knew it was kind of happening. We made some kind of commentary about it, but we didn't understand the significance of it. Now, the government, we could say that the government's to blame in its intelligence for not understanding what was going to happen. But as we both said at the time last week, you anticipate that the Americans will somehow or other, through their incredible kind of abilities and resources, have worked out what the kind of problems are and will have covered you from them. And what we discovered was that they hadn't in any way whatsoever. That was incredibly difficult. So I don't know whether it was dilatory governance on the part of the British government. I mean, when it comes to these things, I don't reside a lot of confidence in this government and its strategic overview and its capacity to manage disasters. I just don't see it. And other people may regard that as being unfair. I hope that if this were a government more to my liking and it were to reveal the similar characteristics, then I would be similarly critical.
I mean, we should point out as well, there's an amazing stat, which I think I first saw on Question Time last week. Lisa Nandy, the shadow foreign secretary, Dominic Raab's opposite number, had never mentioned the word Afghanistan in the House of Commons until Parliament was recalled last week. So it's not like the opposition were particularly across this and recognising that there was going to be an issue, that our key ally in Afghanistan had set a deadline, which we seem to be completely... caught off guard by. I suspect in part because attention of media, political establishment, the government and the opposition very much focused on coronavirus. And this is one of the things which seems to have slipped past us. One of the other big things that the world faces right now is climate change. We had that report a couple of weeks ago warning it was red alert for the planet. And well, we've just sort of forgotten all about it and gone back to our business. Extinction Rebellion are in London right now, David, trying to put it back on the agenda again. Does unveiling a big pink table and lying underneath a transit van, does that help or hinder the climate cause, do you think?
I don't honestly know, but... You know, London's full of people demonstrating about one thing or another. And at least with Extinction Rebellion, their cause is a good one. Whereas with half the people wandering around London, their causes are bad. The only thing I would say is you can only measure these things really by their impact. Does it help persuade people do the things that you want it to do? And the short answer is, by and large, if you really piss people off, then it won't help you.
Language,
much.
David. But, there might. But if I, it, mean, it, I mean, it's unlikely, but there might be children listening.
You think they don't know that phrase? You don't think British children know that word and don't use that word every day? Okay, well, fair enough. It's your show, so I shan't affright it with my appalling language anymore. I shall just call you out the first time I hear you say it. But anyway, if you make people fed up, then in that case, it doesn't necessarily help your cause very much. If, on the other hand, you manage to do it in such a way that you don't make them fed up and you draw attention to it, then that's what good, decent protest is for. So those are my kind of conditions. By and large, these demonstrations are good for the people who are on them and aren't particularly effective about changing people's opinions. But that's not a total iron rule, and that can change.
Well, I don't. Can I say that I don't actually agree that their cause is a good one? We're all against man-made climate change, with the exception of a few people, but the vast majority of people are against man-made climate change. The question is, what we're going to do about it? And so it's a bit like me deciding I'm going to sit in the middle of Trafalgar Square arguing that we need to stop murder, and we're going to do that by building a large pile of sugar sachets. And you say, well, what's that going to do about it? I'm going to say nothing, but at least I'm against murder. And the question with Extinction Rebellion is not, are they against climate change, but are they presenting a coherent, useful way of dealing with climate change? And do they have to sit in Trafalgar Square in order to get people to do it? And the answer to those things in both cases is neither. So I'm sympathetic with the fact that they think that climate change is an existential threat. They are completely correct about that, but lots of people are correct about that, and it doesn't mean that their cause, what they're demonstrating for, is right. As it so happens, I don't think it is. That doesn't mean they don't have the right to be there. It doesn't mean that you can't have respect for their passion. It doesn't mean that you don't have respect for their sense of urgency about the problems that concern themselves. But I can't agree to say that their cause is a right one, because their cause isn't just dealing with climate change. Their cause is the whole variety of things that they plan to do about it, most of which are either counterproductive or completely impossible.
You're precisely right about this, which is that they're not, I don't think that they believe that most people don't think climate change is a problem. I think that they are arguing that what we are doing about it is insufficient. And in many ways, that's a perfectly respectable argument. And if you feel that what you're doing about it is insufficient, then saying so and arguing so is obviously an important part of what you do. So that goes back to the point that I was making, which is persuading people to support and do the things which you need to do in order to give effect to your concern about climate change. It's no surprise to discover there are quite a lot of people who say they're concerned about climate change who actually balk at things that you might do about it and so on. So that's not a completely unreasonable thing for some of them to say.
Well, I think that they balk at some of the things that you might do about it, because my view is that the answer to climate change will ultimately lie in technological and economic development in green directions. And they essentially oppose the capitalist economy that might solve the problem. So, I mean, I may be wrong about this, by the way, but what I'm trying to illustrate is that this is an argument about the means that you use. And simply saying they feel really strongly about it and it's really urgent, that is perfectly reasonable point of view, but it's not different to how lots and lots of people feel, and it doesn't mean that they're making a coherent point or that their point is universally universally accepted as virtuous. They're making an argument that goes far beyond climate change is very important and we ought to do something about it, and we're not doing the right things. They go into what they think the right things are, and I don't think those are the right things.
Yeah, and if you go on their website, Extinction Rebellion, that, you know, there's an awful lot about the means. They say conventional approaches of voting, lobbying, petitions, and protests have failed because powerful political and economic interests prevent change. Our strategy is therefore one of non-violent, disruptive civil obedience, a rebellion. They say they go on to talk about we do not want to seize power; we want to place power in the hands of citizens. And part of me is thinking, well, ultimately, realistically, if you are actually going to bring about change, it is going to be done through,
well,
politics.
They're also wrong about something, I think, in that sense. And actually, they diminish, in a way, their own achievement in argument. Because what I pick up is that actually there is a very significant commitment by all kinds of parts of society and by people. This goes back to Danny's point, which I agree with, about actually not just the thing itself, but about doing quite a lot about it. There's really is quite a big commitment to it. It's whether it's sufficient. I don't agree with Danny that all the answers are technological. I don't think he meant quite to suggest that they were all technological. There are quite significant changes we will have to make to some of the things that we do in order to make sure that we hit the one point, we stay within within the 1.5 degrees model, and that includes heading for net zero emissions ourselves and all kinds of other stuff which we've got to do. And I would like to see, obviously, the demonstrators pay a little bit more attention to the other detail of that and not be quite so pessimistic about what it is that so far the argument has managed to achieve. Because one of the things I think you've got to give to people is the idea that this actually can be done, and so on. And really catastrophist talking can sometimes and quite often be demobilising rather than mobilising. I think you've got to say it's incredibly urgent, we've got to do stuff about it, and we are doing quite a few, so we've got to do a fair bit more. We can get there.
Yeah, and I suppose the question is whether, because one of the demands on there is they talk about citizens, government must create and be led by the decisions of a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. And sometimes actually governments have to take difficult decisions that aren't, you know, universally popular. And what you might get out of a citizens' assembly might not necessarily, I suppose it's slightly confusing that the idea of what they think very strongly is necessarily the same as what everyone else thinks. But it's always nice to have both of you on to tell us what the things that you disagree about too.
That was Danny Finkelstein and David Wanovich today. You can read them both in the Times of your week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Coming up, what's really going on in the G7?
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. I'm Matt Jolly. Now it's time for this.
Yes, at 2:30 today, Boris Johnson will admit his fellow world leaders into his Zoom meeting of the G7 to discuss the crisis unfolding in Afghanistan. The NATO and UN General Secretaries have also been invited to join the discussion. The mood is grim and a long way from those slightly peculiar, chummy, backslapping pictures we saw when Boris Johnson hosted the G7 in person in Cornwall earlier this summer. Speaking overnight, the Prime Minister said the priority was to coordinate our response to the immediate crisis, to reaffirm our commitment to the Afghan people, and to ask our international partners to match the UK's commitment to support those in need. But privately, Downing Street making clear that Boris Johnson will try to press President Biden to keep US troops at Kabul airport beyond the deadline agreed with the Taliban of August the 31st. But following a warning of consequences from the Taliban if that happened, the American president is thought to be unlikely to heed those warnings and will still remove the US troops as planned. So what we thought we'd do is have a tour of the G7 to find out exactly what is happening in the various parts of the world, the leading economies and democracies. Let's get the picture then, first of all, from America. Sarah Baxter is a writer of the US Diary for the Sunday Times and told us earlier that Joe Biden's list of priorities today does not include keeping his G7 allies happy.
Joe Biden is between a rock and a hard place. Of course, he wants to make nice with European allies, with the G7. But he's far more worried, actually, about what the US military is telling him, that he has to decide right now, pretty much, whether or not he's going to meet that August 31st deadline for withdrawing troops or risk leaving them behind and subject to attacks by either the Taliban or possibly even ISIS. So he's got a lot on his mind. Thousands are being evacuated all the time. But the priority, very clearly directed by the US government, is for US citizens and green card holders to come out first. There are reports, some denied by the State Department, that people with the right to be evacuated, you know, Afghan allies, translators, are being sent back. So the situation is still very chaotic. And much as he'd love to be, you know, back chumming around with the G7, I think he's not too worried about his allies at the moment. He's far more worried about what's going on the ground and the domestic implications for the Democrats, which are not good.
That was Sarah Baxter for the Sunday Times, giving the picture from America. Let's find out now, slightly closer to the home, that what's going on in France? What's the attitude to events in Afghanistan? And what's the public mood like there? Let's speak to Dominique Tricand, a former defence advisor to President Macron. Good morning.
Good morning.
There's some suggestions that President Macron might be supportive of Boris Johnson's calls for an extension of US forces staying in Afghanistan. Is that right? Is that what you're hearing?
Yes, that's right. I mean, we think that there was big mistakes in the intelligence gathering by the US, then in the planning for withdrawing, and all the allied were put in front of the problem. And our analysis is that we have no time to extract the people before the deadline. And the deadline was established by the Taliban and the US only. So we will try to change the mind of the US, even if it's difficult. And we are working closely with the UK in the G7, but also at the Security Council. Currently, the two missions are working on a resolution trying to help to solve the problem.
And I mean, I suppose it's one thing trying to change Joe Biden's mind. It would also require changing the mind of the Taliban, wouldn't it?
Well, of course, but the Taliban will be very difficult to change their mind. It's happened that yesterday I was on the Arab channel talking to Taliban, and you can understand very clearly that they don't want to compromise. They said there is an agreement, you must fulfill to the agreement, and that's it. And this is your problem, because you are in the end of the American for this agreement. And now they don't say that, but we understand that we are in the end of the Taliban, because this agreement was done between the US and the Taliban.
We also, in the UK, there's been lots of focus on how many British nationals have been evacuated out of Afghanistan, the role of British troops there. What is the involvement of the French military? How many French nationals are there? Is it a big issue there too?
No, I mean, it's less than in UK, because France, as you know, has left militarily in 2014. So it's an old story. But and we've got very few nationals. So the nationals have been withdrawn, including the national from European country with the delegation of Europe. The problem is mainly on the Afghan, and we are trying to solve the problem of the Afghan who were working for the French army. Still, some of them are in Afghanistan, but a lot of them have been extracted from Kabul. The other problem is the other. I mean, around the airport, you've got a lot of people who have no real reason to go out from Kabul, except that they are afraid from the Taliban. So it's very difficult to draw the list of the people who will be taken out from Kabul. Currently, the list is mainly journalists, artists, people who openly have been facing the Taliban. So we want to protect them. But for the French national, European national, and the people who have been working for the French army, the problem is roughly solved, even if we've got still some people who are in Kabul.
And what about the sort of domestic politics of this? Where's public opinion in France in terms of French involvement? And there's been already quite a lot of reaction to Emmanuel Macron calling for a plan to sort of manage the Afghan migration. Obviously, migration's a big political issue in France, and the prospect of lots of Afghans arriving in France ahead of the French presidential elections will be a big political headache for him, won't it?
Yes, yes, you're right. I mean, in France, in 8 months, we'll have a presidential election. So everybody's taking any subject to discuss with President Macron. I think his speech was very clear. First, the national. Secondly, those who supported the French army, for example. And thirdly, those who are on direct threat. Then the rest, they will have to leave in Afghanistan, because we can't have everybody coming in France or in Europe. And Afghanistan needs people to oppose Taliban in the long term, not only with Commander Massoud's son with their weapon, but also in public opinion, in media and all that. I know it's sometimes harsh to say that, but they've got to defend their country.
It's really good to be to get the pitch there from France. That's Dominique Tricon, a former defence advisor to President Macron. What we're doing is just having a tour of all of the G7 countries ahead of Boris Johnson hosting that summit this afternoon. Let's head to Italy now. Times Italy correspondent Philip Willen is there. Hi, Philip.
Hello.
What's the view from Italy in terms of how things are unfolding in Afghanistan and Italy's involvement?
Well, I think the Italians have taken pretty much the same view as nearly everybody else in world opinion, seeing this as a complete disaster that they found themselves caught up in because of their role in Afghanistan. It was reported that Italy had tried to convince the Americans to delay their withdrawal even some time ago. And handle things in a different way. And I think the Italians, like other NATO allies, have been very unhappy to be not to be consulted and not really to have any say in how this disaster is unfolding. So I think public opinion has been very shocked. And there's also been a great outpouring of solidarity for the people who assisted the Italian troops when they were in Herat, and also the people involved in working for NGOs, working on nation building, what Joe Biden said was not the mission. I think that's what Italians felt was really worthwhile in their involvement in these 20 years in Afghanistan.
And what's the situation now in terms of trying to get some of those Afghan workers, interpreters and so on, who helped the Italian military? Is there an effort to get them out? Is there is that a thing which is happening right now?
Absolutely, yes. It's been very chaotic and difficult. But I believe that in proportion, Italy has evacuated as many as any other country involved. At one stage, apparently, women who had a justification for being evacuated by the Italians were being identified with red sashes on their arms in the crowd so that they could identify themselves and actually get access to Kabul Airport. But the Italians have definitely been putting in a big effort, and the refugees, interpreters and their families have been arriving at different airports in the country since the beginning of the evacuation.
And just finally, Philip, in terms of the what happens next and the risk of another migrant crisis hitting Europe, I mean, just because of geographically where it is, Italy tends to be on the front line. Is that a concern politically in Italy right now?
It is absolutely. The right-wing parties that oppose immigration are saying that Italy must take in an absolute minimum of Afghans, only those with a very strong justification for having assisted Italian troops. So there is a lot of concern about that people will be arriving on Italian borders and adding to very large numbers of people coming over from North Africa. The other thing, of course, is Italy has the presidency of the G20, and Prime Minister Mario Draghi has made it clear that he wants to involve other major world powers such as Russia and China in discussions over the future. And it does seem that that makes perfect sense, that major powers in the area obviously have to be involved in discussions of the future of this very troubled country.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the outcome of the G7 today is in terms of Russia and China influence and involvement. Really good to speak to you, Philip Willen there in Italy. Let's go to Canada now, where the crisis in Afghanistan is coloured by an upcoming prime ministerial election. Let's hear this now from the Times reporter. It is Charlie Mitchell in Ottawa.
Canadians are traditionally extremely welcoming when it comes to refugees and immigrants, and Canadians absolutely feel a sense of responsibility towards the Afghans who helped Canadian forces in Afghanistan. Canada's combat role there actually ended in 2011, but overall 40,000 Canadians served in Afghanistan and over 158 died between 2001 and 2014. The issue has played out against the backdrop of an election in Canada. Justin Trudeau, who's hoping to turn his minority government into a majority, has faced criticism for calling the election amid two major challenges, the fourth wave of the pandemic and the Afghanistan withdrawal. He found himself under attack at the start of the campaign for failing to foresee, as many did, the pace of the Taliban advance, and for the bureaucratic barriers that people trying to come to Canada appeared to be facing. The early signs are that his lead in the polls is evaporating, and it seems that the Afghanistan withdrawal will continue to colour the election campaign. He has not yet joined the criticism of Biden's handling of the issue, but I suppose one wonders if that could change if the polls continue to turn against Trudeau. So far, Canada has airlifted more than 1,700 Canadians and eligible Afghans who helped Canadian forces. The government was criticised for not allowing soldiers to leave the airport to collect people, but that appears to have changed by Sunday when military officials said that Special Forces soldiers had been working outside the confines of the airport to help evacuees get through the security gates. But while the UK has recalled Parliament to discuss Afghanistan, Trudeau has suspended it to call his election. He is, though, attending the G7 meeting and will, alongside the UK, push countries to consider new sanctions against the Taliban. Given his immediate political future is at stake, he will be as keen as any to ensure a solution is found to this challenge. He has said the entire focus of the Canadian government is on getting people out into safety as quickly as possible. As I say, Canada's rescued 1,000 people already, and it's trying to rescue 6,000 support staff and their families and Afghans who helped Canada before the August 31st deadline and the end of evacuation flights. Overall, the government has pledged to take 21,000 Afghans, including civil society leaders, journalists, etc. But Trudeau acknowledged while on the campaign trail that unless the Taliban shifts its posture significantly, it's going to be very difficult to get everybody out.
That was Charlie Mitchell, Times reporter in Ottawa, coming to the picture from Canada. Let's head to Germany now. Journalist there, Katrine Pribble, joins us live. Good morning, Katrine.
Yes.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. I can hear you. Good morning. Nice to have you with us. Well, earlier on, we got the picture from France and Emmanuel Macron supporting Boris Johnson in at least hoping for an extension in the deadline of US forces leaving Afghanistan. We were also led to believe that Angela Merkel is in agreement and she's sort of on Boris Johnson's side on this one, which isn't always the case.
Very much so. So the German government really is in favor of extending those evacuation flights. So I do think they will try to push, in accordance with Boris Johnson and Macron to get Joe Biden to extend this deadline. Yes.
Is there any expectation? Because I suppose everyone wants the deadline extended because it would mean that more people can be taken out to safety. Even if Joe Biden is persuaded to change his mind during this Zoom call later on of the G7 leaders, it all comes down to the Taliban, though, doesn't it? And whether or not, so far, they've said that if American troops are still there beyond the deadline, there will be consequences.
Oh, yes. And I think that's the problem at the moment, isn't it? But I mean, in Germany, there has been a huge discussion and very harsh criticism towards the government because of its handling of its local stuff. They were just not quick enough. So it was quite slow in the beginning. So they're trying to keep up now and to actually get more local stuff, who have helped the German Bundeswehr over the years to get out. The problem in Germany a bit is that we've got the election in September. So everyone is a bit careful, I guess, to make big promises, especially we talked about this before regarding Italy, especially because of immigration and a possible refugee crisis again.
Obviously, this is the sort of the swan song of Angela Merkel. She had her last in-person meeting of the G7 with Boris Johnson in the summer. You know, she'll get to see them all on a screen today. To what extent is German politics sort of moving on from the Merkel era? Her potential successors, are they taking a different line in terms of the amount of support that they want to give to Afghanistan, the number of refugees that they might take?
I don't really think so. And I mean, we also have to remember that although Angela Merkel was very welcoming in the beginning during the refugee crisis in 2015, it was quite quickly the picture has changed back then. And then the borders were closed and so on. And at the moment, it's just a discussion how many people Germany should take in and if any. So we hear from her successor or possible successor, the leader of the Conservative Party, Armin Laschet, that it's more about, you know, helping people in neighboring countries, Afghanistan, helping in the region. And although almost two-thirds of the German public is actually in favor of taking in more vulnerable Afghan refugees, I think this is it's becoming a campaign issue now, which hasn't been the case a few weeks ago. But Germany has already taken in more than 500,000 Afghan refugees in the last few years. So the question really is now whether more refugees will be welcome. The Green Party, on the other hand, their candidate for the election asked for up to 50,000 Afghans to relocate to Germany. But I feel like it's just a very sensitive issue, and everyone is very careful to make any big promises or everyone is kind of careful to not have a repetition of 2015, which has had a very lasting impact on German politics, as we know.
It's really good to speak to get that picture from Germany. Katrin Pribble there, a journalist in Germany, giving us the picture from there. Let's head to Japan now to complete the set of the G7. Ko Hirano is politics and foreign affairs editor for Kyodo News in Tokyo. Good to have you with us. We can hear you now. Good to have you with us here on Times Radio. What has been Japan's involvement in Afghanistan, and what are the current concerns there?
Yes, we in Japan, we are very, how can I say, regrettable about the situation in Afghanistan, because Japan's policy has been to stabilize the country, Afghanistan, and never make the country again as a hotbed of terrorism. So we have been extended a total of $6.6 billion US dollars since 2001 to train, for example, police forces in Afghanistan and other civil measures, extending a vocational training for former Taliban soldiers so that they can integrate into society again. And of course, they have extended lots of aid assistance for agriculture and infrastructure building and education and health area. So despite these efforts, the fall of Kabul, earlier this month was a setback for Japan's effort to, stabilize the country. And of course, this has been coordination with other G7 countries, Europe and US, of course.
And what about there seems to be a lot of discussion about China and different countries saying that both Russia and China sort of need to be brought into this conversation, obviously being geographically much closer to China than many of the other countries in the G7. What is the view in Japan of that?
Yes, this U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, we are very concerned about so-called power vacuum of the U.S. American forces from the region. It's a concern, and we are kind of we have seen many patterns, but China would use the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan as an example to assert its claim to undermine U.S. credibility in defense of allies and partners, especially in the Indo-Pacific, when you see tensions surrounding Taiwan, for example, and of course China's aggressive claims into territories, territorial disputes into, you know, like Vietnam and the Philippine South China Sea, and of course in China's aggressive claims in the Japanese controlled islands in East China Sea. So we are worried about, you know, America's how can I say China's use of this case, Afghanistan case, as an example. Yes.
Ko Hirano, thanks very much for joining us live from Tokyo there, politics and foreign affairs editor of the Kyodo News, giving us just rounding us off there on how this meeting is being viewed in Japan. That's a full tour of the G7. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.